Let's get it.
Number five.
The Baseball Hall of Fame voting will be revealed tonight, Joe. It's the last time on the ballot for Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds. Neither is expected to hit the 75% threshold to be enshrined in Cooperstown. It's the first time for David Ortiz, the Red Sox slugger, who had his own past issues with steroid use, PED use. How will we tap dance around such legacies?
Well, Ortiz is not a first ballot Hall of Famer, so he's not going to get in regardless. That's not to say that, you know, during the time, you know, the next 10 years, he won't get in. I can envision him getting in. And let's also not forget about Curt Schilling. I believe this is also his
last. Do we have to remember Curt Schilling?
Well, so here's where these things, you know, I think that Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens and then Curt Schilling are two separate conversations, right? Well, they're separate conversations, but they're not at the same time. And I'll explain. Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds are being held out of the Hall of Fame because of PEDs, right? Now, the PEDs are the cover for what people really feel about Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, as in they just don't like the guy. They just don't like the guy. Or the guys, I should say. Barry Bonds never really endeared himself to the media and fans. He's always kind of cantankerous. It's fine. It's whatever. But that's not what these things should be about. It's not whether you like the guy or not. Were they a Hall of Fame baseball player or not? And in the case of Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, regardless of how you feel of them as people, are. Okay, well, what about the performance-enhancing drugs? Well, what about them? They happened. Major League Baseball, well, it's not even Major League Baseball's. The Baseball Hall of Fame is a museum, okay? What do you do with museums, Julia?
You include all parts of history, not just the ones you want.
If you're telling the story of baseball, you have to tell the story of baseball, warts and all. You know, like, we've suddenly gone into critical baseball theory when we talk about who belongs in the Hall of Fame and who doesn't belong in the Hall of Fame. You can't keep all the good parts in and keep all the bad parts out. That's not how it works. Especially when you already have people in the hall that have done bad things, okay? So, and let's strip out whether or not Barry Bonds did bad things or not, in your opinion, based on PEDs. All right, let's just keep it to PEDs in general. Then explain to me why Bud Selig was eventually involved in the Hall of Fame. Why was he included in the Veterans Committee?
I can't. I'm sorry.
This was the commissioner on record when all of this was happening. And as we know, turned a blind eye to it. Why did they turn a blind eye to it? Butts were in seats. Television ratings were going up. With ratings going up, television revenue went up with it. There was more interest in the game based on the long ball, okay? There were ad campaigns around chicks digging the long ball. We willfully accepted all of this. And I guess to assuage our guilt, we want to punish Barry Bonds for that? No, you don't get to do that. And this is really simple. As a museum, you put on the plaque the whole story. You include the fact that Barry Bonds was a Hall of Fame player before he started taking. You include the fact that Barry Bonds did all the things you would ever want out of a high-level, Hall of Fame-level baseball player. All the numbers he was putting up, the trajectory he was putting up, and everything else. And then you get to the part where steroids comes in, and you tell that story on the plaque. I don't know why this is difficult. And what happens with Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, and to a certain extent Curt Schilling, actually makes it easier for me to argue against writers being the arbiter of who gets into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Because we start casting our own moral judgment on these types of things rather than telling the story of the game in an objective fashion. That's my problem with the Baseball Hall of Fame in a nutshell. And that includes Curt Schilling, who should be in the Hall of Fame, even if he's not a good person.
Well, so, I mean, not being a good person should not be part of the criterion, right?
No, it shouldn't.
But were his pitching statistics good enough to be in the Hall of Fame? Because that's the thing about baseball, right?
Yeah.
300 wins. We have certain standards. 3,000 hits. Used to be 500 home runs. Mm-hmm. But all those standards have been skewed and changed.
For me, I guess with Schilling, you look at his postseason success.
Okay.
If
I change Curt Schilling's name to Julian Edelman,
including the bloody sock. Including the bloody sock.
Since I know how you feel about Julian Edelman.
Well, Julian Edelman, to me, you understand the differences between, you know, Curt Schilling as a starting pitcher
right
in Major League Baseball in postseason play versus a wide receiver who was accumulating stats, right?
I don't know. You're talking about someone who had an unbelievable postseason career. Two people. That's the same, right?
No,
I'm just saying he doesn't get to the standard.
They're not the same based on position and also the sport, too. So
right. But you're making the point that Curt Schilling should be in the Hall of Fame primarily because of his postseason success, right? Not just the Red Sox, but he helped the Phillies get there, and he won one with the Diamondbacks as well, right?
So here's the problem when people start talking about the Baseball Hall of Fame with me, mm-hmm. is that I don't get too wrapped up in the numbers aspect of it.
Yeah, but that's what the Hall of Fame is, Joe.
I'm with you. I'm with you in that the numbers have – you can manipulate the numbers all you want. Like, I got all sorts of issues how we process the Hall of Fame. Like, the fact that it takes 10 years to process somebody. Why is somebody more of a Hall of Famer in year 9 than they were in year 1? Right?
Right.
Either you are or you aren't. I understand you want to make a distinction between a first ballot Hall of Famer and the not. For, you know, not all Hall of Famers are created equally. You want to create an S-tier Hall of Famer and everything else. I get all those particular things. For me, in the Hall of Fame, it kind of comes down to, do I know you? Like, are you a recognizable baseball player? Like, you've done things that people go, yep. It's like the Leonardo DiCaprio meme from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He gets up from the couch and he points, right? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
That's kind of like my baseline for a lot of Hall of Fame discussions, which would include David Ortiz, because I know there's a larger conversation about David Ortiz as a designated hitter and whether or not designated hitters belong in the Hall of Fame, just like relief pitchers, and whether or not specialized positions belong in the Hall of Fame. You know, you have like the one with Mariano Rivera as the most dominant relief pitcher of all time. He clearly belonged in the Hall of Fame. What do you do with somebody like David Ortiz? But all of those come down to one real simple criteria for me. Get up off the couch and point at him. Yep. Yeah, that guy. Sometimes you just know. And in that particular case, I think that's where Curt Schilling comes into play.
I'm just looking now at the career wins list. I mean, Pedro Martinez only had 219. He's in.
Yep.
And there's an adjustment that they've made for career wins in the last 10 years based on specialization of pitchers. And, you know, obviously no one's going to be Cy Young with 511 wins anymore.
That doesn't exist anymore.
Speaking of untouchable records.
Yeah, and also, I don't think if Bonds doesn't get in by the boat, I don't think he's going to get in with the Today's Game Committee.
Because I think he eventually will.
Because I think my understanding is there's 16 people on that committee made up of, you know, four Hall of Famers, executives, media members. You need 12 of the 16 to get on, and there's enough animosity towards Bonds and PEDs that...
Well, they're all, yeah. But the attitude's already changed.
This is how Harold Baines gets it.
The attitude's already changed, though. So I'm confident that the attitudes will continue to change and adjust.
I hope so. I hope so, too, because ultimately, this is where I learned from you, Julio.
Yeah.
This is where years and years and years and years of years me arguing about the PED era of baseball. And that ultimately, when we get away from the immediacy of it, we're going to recognize that it was a lot more prevalent than we cared to believe. There was much more of an even playing field than we were acting like there was. And also, you come to the realization that PEDs, and if we talk about the baseline of extending your career, not all that different from what guys were doing before PEDs, like amphetamines and whatnot, greenies, to get yourself up for the next game and those types of things. We've always had some level of a performance enhancer. It just kind of depends on how you want to view it through whatever prism, you know, whatever lens you want to view it through. And ultimately, my attitude towards this, people have come around to, finally. It's been 10 years.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Like, give it another 10 years, it'll change even more. I mean, you can't leave out. Like, it's not hyperbole to say that Barry Bonds is the best player in baseball history.
Of course not.
Like...
Of course not. That is not a crazy opinion.
You can make a legitimate argument.
Yes.
So you seem to be drawing some line in the sand for Pete Rose, which I don't understand.
I feel Pete Rose.
Because if it's history and if it's a museum, then...
But I feel that Pete Rose is a bright line as it relates to the integrity of the game more than anything else. like you legitimately call into question the integrity of the game when you start to gamble on it. And I don't care if he was gambling on them only to win, right?
But was he? Well, I guess he was a player manager at the time.
When he was a gambling, player manager at the time. With, you know, you and I agree on one thing as it relates to PEDs. You and I could take the same drugs Barry Bonds was taking. Are we hitting those home runs?
No,
no. Barry Bonds could not.
Brian Kingman could take the same drugs and not hit
and not hit those home runs. But you know who had a direct impact on the outcomes of games? The manager, depending on who he wanted to put out there with a lineup, who he wanted to put out there on the mound, all those types of things, while he was compromised under gambling debts. That, to me, there's no walking back from that. None. At all. So that's where I draw a bright line, because all those other instances, there's nuance of the state of the game, and you still have to hit the freaking ball and all that other kind of stuff.
Aren't those attitudes changing, though? Already.
In terms of what?
In terms of our acceptance of gambling. It's the same premise as PED, right?
No, I still think the acceptance of gambling is in the form of a consumer, and whether or not leagues should actually be in partnership with gambling outfits. I'm perfectly okay with that. But the minute I find out that an athlete is directly tied to gambling on his own games, I'm done. I'm done. Because you're no different from the WWE at that point. Is that what we want?
I think the WWE puts people into the Hall of Fame multiple times. Like, Ric Flair's in the Hall of Fame like four different times.
I think like four different times, yes. But it becomes scripted entertainment at that point. It becomes scripted. Michael Jordan gambling on the golf course, I don't care. If Michael Jordan wanted to gamble on baseball games, NFL games back in the day, I don't care. But the minute it crosses over into the manipulation, point shaving, those types of things, as we've seen in sports before, Boston College, et cetera, right? Everybody go watch Goodfellas. That's when we have a problem. You can't have that happen.
In England, the British Open, right? Yeah. A lot of golfers will put money on themselves to win the British Open.
They're betting on themselves, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Is that different from what Pete Rose did?
Why are you bringing this up now?
Well, I'm just...
It's already 5:17.
I did not know you had this Pete Rose stance until the previous conversation about it. Now I'm interested because at the beginning you said it's a museum and you can't whitewash history.
Yeah.
If Pete Rose has more hits than anybody in history, mm-hmm. Apply the same standard. Put the plaque in there. Say, put in there. Mm-hmm. As the manager and as the player manager of the Cincinnati Reds, he put money on games, and he clearly broke Major League Baseball rules.
Yeah, if you want to put that on the plaque, that's fine by me. That's fine by me. But maybe I'm conflating the two of Baseball Hall of Fame, which has nothing to do. And I know, you know, before I get the tweets or the emails or worse, you know, like gold texting me, I understand that baseball's ban of Pete Rose has nothing to do with the Major League, with the Baseball Hall of Fame. They just decided to use that as a shield for having to deal with the issue. If they want to put him in with that plaque, that's fine. I guess my issue ultimately is the reinstatement of Pete Rose to Major League Baseball. No, never can happen. Zero time for that.
Yeah, we're past that bridge.
Yeah, we're past that bridge. And in terms of things like golfers and whatnot, I will say that Phil Mickelson has done one of the most amazing things where people just don't want to look the opposite way of all of his gambling debts.
I would be stunned if Phil didn't put money on himself to win the PGA last year. I'd be floored. Yeah. The number was way too high.
Are we still on number five?
Are we? Look at that.
Yeah, that's why I was kind of like, oh, man, why are you asking these questions now?
Just a little behind the curtain for you, Joe, when you're not here. This is the most difficult segment for me to do.
Why?
Because there's no break. I have to talk the whole time. Rand's over there doing whatever Rand does.
Wordle.
Right? Yes, as you've proven sometimes. Wordle.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you could stretch out number five for a good solid 19 minutes, that's a good day's work on the What's
Trending.
Right,
let's rifle through the other one, shall we?
Number four.
Speed round. So Urban Meyer decided in his infinite wisdom to read the room on a Monday following the divisional round that produced some insane NFL playoff results and go, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to talk to Dan Dodge.
Call my guy from Bowling Green.
I'm going to give him an exclusive on what went wrong with me in Jacksonville. What could Urban Meyer possibly said that we didn't already know as to why it didn't work in Jacksonville. Here's what he told Dan Dockage.
And it's not, you know, I love and respect most everybody in that building. And I went in there as hard as I possibly can to try to, I mean, hard to try to win and turn things around and maybe push some people the wrong way. But, you know, I'm a pusher. I'm a guy that's always going to push. I mean, push hard. And some,
oh, we saw him push hard in club
for people, but winning is not comfortable. Growth is not comfortable. Change is not comfortable.
The club wasn't comfortable.
And that's it.
Yeah, that's it. So Urban basically spent the time talking about how, you know, winning and losing, you know, he just takes it at a level that nobody can comprehend. And I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially he was like, you know, they accept losing in the NFL. I couldn't accept losing. I lost five in a row. I couldn't eat or sleep. And, you know, people are just moving on with their lives. No. There's a difference between accepting losing and understanding in the NFL that you're going to lose some games. It's how you course correct after you lose games. And that's something that Urban Meyer never is able to do because he never had to learn that lesson in college. Because he could just, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll recruit you next season.
More better players.
Can't do that in the NFL, man. Everybody's good. So, oh well. Urban Meyer will probably show up on TV before you know it. Next up.
Number three.
North Carolina got back into the win column with a 78-68 decision at home against Virginia Tech last night at the Smith Center. They take on Boston College on Wednesday, which will then set them up for Saturday's home game against NC State. Tar Heels, 13-6 overall, 5-3, Joe. The number that's important, though, is still the one in the net that says 0-6 in quadrant one games. They do have four Q1 games remaining, though. They just need to get to them, and they need to kind of just plow through these appendix games and notch them up, chalk them up, throw them in the right column, and then maybe try to figure out a way to build some confidence and figure out their defensive deficiencies before they see Duke on Saturday the 5th.
I don't see it happening. I mean, they'll beat Boston College on Wednesday. It's entirely possible for them to beat NC State on Saturday, given the way that North Carolina season has gone and has as streaky as NC State can be. But Hubert Davis is trying everything, man. He's trying to talk him up, love him up. And that's what he did after last night's win against Virginia Tech, which, to their credit, they didn't allow another bad shooting night, including a 5 or 6 minute scoring drought, to get the best of them. And they managed to squeeze out a win there late against Virginia Tech.
To stay with it through ups and downs, turnovers, defensively, we had lapses. There was a togetherness about this team that I was just very proud of them about. And in the huddle, this is the first time where guys were talking about toughness, perseverance, and let's stick together. And the communication, amongst teammates, the energy was really good in the huddle. Even when it looked like, you know, things were turning, we all stayed together. And so I was really, really proud of them tonight.
I forgot how bad.
That was Hubert.
Yeah, I forgot how bad Duke was last year. Carolina's 20-1. At home since the start of last season.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to find the good wins. And then I'm like, oh, they beat Duke last year. No, Duke was crap last year on a stick. They beat Florida State at home last year. That was their best win.
Yeah, I will admit that I've been soft on North Carolina for a variety of reasons. Biggest one being it's Hubert Davis's first season as head coach with a roster that got Roy Williams so frustrated that he retired. So we have to understand the circumstances of the season and how you build from there. North Carolina doesn't have a right to have Hall of Fame coaches all the time. Yeah, let that thing simmer for a little bit, right? So I've been optimistic about North Carolina in that, you know what, I can see a level of talent, and it's not like the rest of the ACC is all that great. But unfortunately for them, they get rocked sometimes, and they have a hard time getting it back on track, as we saw against Miami and as we saw against Wake Forest. Those are good basketball teams. that happened to. You know, Virginia Tech just hasn't been able to get right this season. Boston College is not good. NC State, again, I think is the outlier here because NC State's probably more comparable to North Carolina in general. The one thing that I can say about State that I cannot say about North Carolina, and we'll talk about this more as we get closer to that game, I don't worry about NC State imploding on itself. NC State will just do what they usually do, and that is grind, grind, grind. Sometimes it works out. Sometimes it doesn't. It's going to be an interesting matchup on Saturday. Next up.
Number two.
So, since I'm stuck at home, since I'm still in COVID isolation here, going on week three, fun. Anyway, I've been watching a lot of ESPN. It's a bit of a problem. And today, the fascinating conversation was around Aaron Rodgers and whether or not the Green Bay Packers should just move on from Aaron Rodgers. And it's like, look, Aaron, I think it was Marcus Spears who said it on ESPN Today, and I agreed with him. It's like, what is your ROI on Aaron Rodgers right now? Yeah, you're winning regular season games. That's cool, but that's not why you have Aaron Rodgers. You have Aaron Rodgers to win playoff games, and Aaron Rodgers is not doing that right now, and he hasn't been doing that. When you ask the baddest man on the planet to elevate his game and elevate the team, it hasn't been there as of late, and is it really worth the squeeze? Is it really worth putting up with all of Aaron Rodgers' stuff, his essence, his aura? And I kind of agree with the attitude of, if you can get something for him in return, you do it, because Aaron Rodgers is going to be his usual self this offseason, and it's going to drive people nuts.
Packers in North Carolina are living parallel lives, right?
Yeah.
North Carolina had two Hall of Fame coaches. Now, the span was longer. It's closer to 60 years. Mm-hmm. Dean Smith, Roy Williams. But the Packers have had Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah.
Excuse me, since 1994. Is that right? 95? 94?
Yeah, I think it's 94.
So, yeah, they're about to figure out what the other half looks like, but that doesn't mean they shouldn't try to figure it out. Now, they drafted Jordan Love. I think we could probably already tell you that Jordan Love's not going to be in that group of Hall of Fame guys. But if they can make a deal that gets them something better, they should.
Next up.
The number one story of the day.
We're number one. We're number one.
So Sean Payton announced that he's stepping away from football. We don't know what he's going to do next, but he also said he wants to stay involved in football in some shape or form. He's only 58 years old. He's got one Super Bowl back in 2009, playoff record of 9-8. They squeezed as much as they could out of Drew Brees there at the end. They did not make the playoffs this year. Even though Taysom Hill is a franchise quarterback apparently, but that's another story altogether. So he's done. All right, so New Orleans is going through transition. Meanwhile, Tampa Bay Buccaneers are going to have to deal with, what will Tom Brady do this offseason? Will he come back or will he finally retire? Tom has multiple podcasts, and I forgot which one of these podcasts it was on, but the message here is that he has to have a conversation with his wife and he has to look at himself in the mirror and understand what kind of dad he wants to be. And I don't know about you, Jillio, but based on this clip, this is for the first time in a long time leaning towards, ooh, Tom might actually retire.
I have kids now too, you know, and I care about them a lot as well. You know, they've been my biggest supporters. My wife is my biggest supporter. It pains her to see me get hit out there. And, you know, she deserves what she needs from me as a husband. My kids deserve what they need from me as a dad.
So that was Tom Brady on one of his like 8 million podcasts that he does. So Sean Payton retires. Saints in a point of transition. The Bucs window was always going to be short. It was going to be a small window. They won a Super Bowl, and they were in contention this year. Tom Brady could retire. They're going to go through a transition. The Falcons are the Falcons. I mean, I really don't know what else to say about that. We understand that Matt Ryan's time is coming to a close as well. This is supposed to be the Panthers' opportunity. This is it. Except you still have Matt Rhule as your head coach and Sam Darnold is your quarterback and your offensive line still stinks. And it's supposed to be a point of optimism, Jillio. This is supposed to be a time for the Panthers to make a move. Instead, the Panthers are going, yeah, we're probably going to be firing our coach after next season anyway.
Matt Rhule's got him right where he wants him, Joe.
It's all part of the 7-year plan,
Jillio. It's all part of the plan. It's 1,000% working. This was part of the plan. Get rid of Tom Brady. Get sweet talk Giselle. Make sure she knew. It's whispering to Tommy's ear. It's over, Tommy. Come on. You don't need any more hits.
Could have been a contender, Matt. Could have been a contender, Tepper. Could have been a contender, Panthers. Instead, you're a hot freaking mess when everything is opening up for you. A hot freaking mess. Oh, well. Looking forward to Ben McAdoo, interim head coach, after week 6.